convocation speaker this morning, Pastor Ronald Bergen, was born in 1936 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he received his elementary, high school, and junior college education. He graduated from this seminary in 1961. Pastor Bergen and his wife Judith, an elementary school teacher, have been blessed by the Lord with three children. Pastor Bergen served congregations in Illinois, New York, and Kent, Ohio. He served the Ohio District in various capacities, also as first, second, and third vice president, before being installed as president in March 1996. He was reelected at the Ohio District Convention in June, a year later. Besides a long tenure of service to the church, Pastor Bergen has continued to enjoy music, gardening, railroading, and stamp collecting. Most importantly of all, however, as we heard from him in yesterday morning's homily, Pastor Bergen has a shepherd's heart for people and a heartfelt desire to get the word of Christ out into hearts and homes. Would you join me then in welcoming our district president in residence, Pastor Ronald Bergen?
Good morning, and it's a pleasure to be here. Again, I thank you for the invitation. I consider it an honor and privilege to be in your midst. This morning, I'm speaking about ministry in an unchurched and non-Christian society. I should add, by way of introduction, I felt very warmly received in the classes that I was attending. That was absolutely delightful. I'd like to read two scripture verses to set the tone for where I'm going. And the first one is in Genesis chapter 11. Now the whole earth had one language and few words. And as men migrated from the east, they found a plain in the west and settled there, and they said to us, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had a brick for brick and stone for stone and bitumen for mortar. And then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city, a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they're one language, and they have all one people. And this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do now will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, that they may not be able to understand one another's speech." Then the second reading is in the book of Acts, in the second chapter, also familiar verses. The day of Pentecost had come. They were all together in one place, and suddenly a sound came from heaven like the rush of a mighty wind. It filled all the earth where they were sitting, and there appeared to them tongues as of fire, distributed and resting on each one of them. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. And I remain convinced today that we're going back and forth between Babel and Pentecost, and Pentecost and Babel, and that's part of what's happening when we talk about a ministry in an unchurched and non-Christian society. I'd like to share with you one of the attempts today that somebody made to blend the world of football with the world of church, and you need to know these definitions about football Christianity. In the church draft time, is the selection of a seat near the door. Halftime is the time between the piece and the offertory. The bench warmers are those who only participate on Sunday morning. The quarterback sneak are those who leave quietly before communion or before the service is over. Here's my favorite one, fumble. Fumble is the person who drops the hymn book or very loudly sings the wrong verse of the hymn. Backfield in motion, making out several trips during the sermon, and that happens with little children. Sometimes you're in the church and there's a steady stream. Backfield in motion. Sudden death is when the pastor goes overtime, and blitz is the stampede to the door after the service. We're in a period of transition, and someone said that that's probably what Adam said to Eve after the fall, and the Lord drove them out of the garden. It doesn't say that in Scripture, but I think that's what took place. Adam looked at Eve and said, I think we're in a period of transition. The difference today is that the pace is so rapid, and if I've been in ministry 38 years, I have rewritten it about every 8 or so years, which meant teaching models, communication models, and what went on in the life of the parish. The knowledge explosion that is taking place, the information explosion, and if you think in your lifetime or not much beyond that, words like television, penicillin, polio shots, antibiotics, frisbees, maybe a generation before, nylon, Dacron, Xerox, Kinsey radar, fluorescent lights, credit cards, ballpoint pens, pantyhose, hardware meant hardware once upon a time. Software wasn't even a word at that time, and a chip was what you had left over when you were doing carpentry, and it was a piece of wood. I served a congregation at Kent, Ohio. It was a university church. There, I was the residential pastor. There was a second pastor as the university campus pastor, and then a DCE who did work in the congregation. I came after the events, and so the historical events at Kent State University took place in 1970. I arrived 9 years after that. John F. Kennedy lived 36 years ago. We talk about exploration. Today, when I talk to Sunday school teachers and younger pastors, and I talk about all these film strips that I was so proud that I used in my instruction class, and they look at me this funny way, what's a film strip? Okay. The world has changed. I look at my collection of long play records that I built when I was here, and now we're in the world of technology, we're in the world of change, we're in the world of that's totally different. Listen to this once. I won't read it all, but I think it's a nice commentary. I ran across this poem. Did Jesus have a modem at the Sermon on the Mount? Did he ever try a broadcast fax to send his message out? Did the disciples carry beepers as they went about their route? Did Jesus use a modem at the Sermon on the Mount? Did Paul use a laptop with lots of RAM and ROM? Were his letters posted on the internet at paul.rome.com? Did the man from Macedonia send an email saying, come? Did Paul use a laptop with lots of RAM and ROM? Did Moses use a joystick at the parting of the sea and a satellite guidance tracking system to show him where to be? Did he really write the law on the tablets, or are they just on CD? Did Moses use a joystick at the parting of the sea? Did Jesus really die for us one day upon a tree? Or was it just a hologram or technical wizardry? Can you download the life action video clip to play on your PC? Did Jesus really die for us one day upon a tree? It goes on, but I think it gives you a gist of the kind of world in which you and I are living and the kind of world in which you are have been called. The United States now is described as one vast foreign mission field. I very much believe that. I very much understand it that way. And one of the things that's going on in congregations, or going on not in congregations, but in the world around us, is ridicule and blasphemy, if you want to call it, irreverence in terms of things sacred. Stand-up comedians make a lot of money, and if you do like I do, and you're in a travel a lot, and you're in a motel, and you see this on cable, it's absolutely incredible what they talk about. And so things like Jesus and communion and sacred words like redemption, and you go right on down the line, these become jokes for a whole sector out there, making big money, making jokes of things sacred. And while that goes on, not just irrelevance, but total irreverence, while that goes on, at the same time there's a whole generation of what you know as seekers, people who show up with an inquisitive look and are looking for answers. Part of our calling is, how do you reach those seekers in today's world? How do you reach them? They're out there. They're not quite sure what they're seeking. One of the things that happens today is that's why there's so many different religions. You go into Borders, you go into Barnes & Noble, and you see shelf upon shelf of a category called New Age, which is kind of a descriptive stuff of all sorts of things. But those are people seeking. And the tragedy today is that the more bizarre the religion is, the more bizarre and off the wall it is, the more people will buy it. I always think of Luther talking about the Schwermerwat Rye, and he always talked about them swallowing it, feathers and all. And I think that's the kind of world we live in. And yet it's a world of opportunity. There are people seeking and desiring to hear the precious gospel. Part of the challenge is that when we, it was interesting to listen in one of the classes yesterday as this was spoken about, there are so many different levels of people within your congregation. The seeker, someone called them the threshold people, the embryonic Christian, the developing Christian, the mature Christian, the old-time Christian, the absolute neophyte, the person who has no idea what it is but wants to learn more. And part of your call is, how do you communicate that one precious gospel to all of them? We live today with what I call the Clintonizing of moral values. And that's absolutely scary of what has happened. And I must admit, I was naive on it until I saw those hearings. And when you can hear the president's defense talking about, yes, there is a double standard. You don't have the same standard for a general or a military office that you do have for the president. When they said double standard, they meant the president had a lesser standard. There's something wrong going on out there. That's the world in which you and I live. So that Christianity is a minority, it is shrinking, numerically declining. It's a percentage that is shrinking. When I began ministry, it was the field of dreams. You put up the building and they all marched in. Today we talk about ethnic ministries and we talk about cross-cultural ministries. In the Ohio District, our newest, and this is kind of an exciting story, our newest cross-cultural ministry is in the Toledo area and in the State University, Bowling Green, and it's a Chinese ministry. That's our newest cross-cultural ministry in the Ohio District, a Chinese ministry. I think that's exciting. But at the same time, when you see people coming into church, there's an illiteracy. And as I talked about reprogramming myself, I got to the point where I had to put many of them simply at square one. And while they were searching, and while it was fun to walk with them on this journey, the truth was that they were illiterate. And we had to start with them on square one about the faith, what the faith was all about. Talk a little bit about my time and who I am. I appreciate that introduction. And I want to go back just a little bit. My teachers, there were about three teachers that were memorable to me. Arthur Carl Peepcorn, who probably is more responsible in our synod for the revival and the serious revival and study of the confessions and symbolics. Really pressed then. He was a giant in the church. The other two were Martin Charlemagne and Fred Danker, who were New Testament scholars. They were slave drivers, you know, and you knew they would be hard courses and you didn't want to take them, but as one of my classmates said, you're a fool not to take that class. You just have to take it. But they taught me the discipline of scholarship. They taught me the discipline of never settling for second rate or second best work. Whatever you did had to be excellence, and you had to do in terms of quality. Some of my classmates taught here. I think I saw you out there before, Richard Warnick, aren't you? There you are. I'm looking right straight on you. And Daniel Picorni, who passed away very suddenly with that in deaf ministry, this was a few years ago. Leroy Vogel, Skip Vogel, who because of illness doesn't even live here anymore, had served as the dean. Those were seminary classmates. Someone can help me on this one. There was a Richard Schultz, and I know he's emeritus. I don't know if he's still living. That's kind of an interesting connection. Someone has to help me with him. He's still listed on the roster of the school. But he goes back a generation. He comes out of the church where I was a vicar, and he was a neighboring pastor when I started out. That was the period of racial tensions heightening. That was the period of all sorts of other stuff. But things changed. My grandfather was a pastor at only one my grandfather on my mother's side was a pastor at only one church in his whole lifetime, 1897 to 1941, at St. John's Lutheran Church in LaGrange on the near west side, really, of the Chicago area. And in the late 20s and early 30s, he was president of the Northern Illinois District. It's interesting, there was no staff then. You know, you just kind of did that on the side out of your parsonage on Stone Avenue. And he had one staff person, his secretary, which was my mother before she was married and before she was my mother, but that was the staff. And I look how things have changed over those years. I came out of a congregation that historically has sent a pastor into the ministry every 2 or 3 years. It started in the 1950s, and the record is intact, as I saw Eric Jensen. And he's just of a continuing stream that began in that congregation in the 1950s, in which I was part of in the early 60s. That stream continues. There are some other congregations like that. The one I was a vicar in Buffalo, every few years out came another pastor. We have a congregation like that now in the Cleveland area, Zion Painesville. There's a number of students here. Every 2 or 3 years out comes another pastor from that congregation. The challenge on that is that that's becoming less and less frequent. And so the students coming in today are often of non-Lutheran background, other interests, second career, did not come through the system as I did. But it's kind of fun to sit here. I showed some of you how these uncomfortable chairs work. You have an obstacle in here now, because we always had a hymnal in these chairs, see? And if you wanted to be comfortable, you slouched down, and then you took the hymnal and you propped it on your knee, and then it kind of hung onto the seat in front of you. It's a challenge because there are no props to support you. You're on your own. I know this building because that's where that beautiful Holtkamp organ stood, and not only is the organ gone now, but they put all the chairs back. I mean, you can't even recognize a trace that was there. In those days, there were no school musicians, that is, on the faculty. It was the students who were the musicians and the organists. I was one of the organists in those days. There were a number of others. But that was really the setting. So I kind of marvel at it when I watched Professor Brower, and I heard Professor Garricky this morning, and heard Michelle play yesterday, that wonderful setting of Mons's God of Grace and God of Glory. And I heard Professor Garricky this morning play Isaiah Mighty Seer in Days of Old. And the way he played that hymn, you know, the beams and lintels were trembling. He did a wonderful presentation of interpretation, but none of that was going on in our day. It was a different world then, and it was a totally different way. But the truth is, we can't rest on the past. It's kind of fun, and I had a lot of fun traveling in our district, but you can't rest on the past. It's a different world today. It's unchurched. It's a heathen society. It's a mission society. The values are changed. And we have to ask, how do we communicate today? I was going to tell you just one word about the Ohio District, and I was going to do it by way of introduction, that so that Professor Veltz would know that I was listening to him, because I heard his distinction between the word connote and denote, and I listened very carefully when he said that. And the thing that comes to your mind when you hear the Ohio District is the state of Ohio, isn't it? But the Ohio District is more than that. There's a lot more to the Ohio District. There's a whole sector in northern Kentucky, and there's all of the state of West Virginia. We do not have many congregations in West Virginia. As a matter of fact, 3 out of 4 are vacant at the moment. As a matter of fact, one of them we're looking for a candidate in, so one of you may be joining us. It's right along it's Huntington, West Virginia, along the river, Ohio River, right next to Ashland, Kentucky. A wonderful congregation, but we cover all 3 of those states. In our district, Schwann is buried, Schwann Catechism, and surrounding his cemetery, he was the one, you know, Christmas tree. And the city of Cleveland on 9th and Prospect has a pillar, a sign, a, a, a monument to the first Christmas tree in a church, and it stands there, erected by the city. Right now, that's right on a big plaza, but that's where the first church was, and it's memorialized in the city. In December, there was a nice article in Lutheran Witness, and if you go to his grave site in Lakeside Cemetery, it's surrounded by Christmas trees. And then if you go to Lutheran Cemetery in Cleveland, on the southwest side, Lutheran Cemetery, Winneken is buried. And Winneken's tombstone is in the shape of a pulpit. It's actually a lectern, more like this, but that's what it's in. And that's his tombstone. So two of the founders are buried up there. I have a standing date with Dr. Barry because his daughter lives up in that area. And I said, when you come, we're going to take you to these places. Early foundings in our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod go back to St. John's Marysville, which is a congregation that's 160 years old. I preached last fall for their 160th anniversary. It's in the middle of a cornfield, a massive worship structure, probably larger, it's brick, probably larger than the chapel here. Several services, a school of 300, and a congregation was going before our synod was founded. That was a charter congregation in our synod. You go to the southwest corner, and there is Zion Shum, another founding congregation. You go to northwest Ohio, and there were 18 congregations founded by a person named John Adam Detzer. 18 congregations. And that meant that you traveled on horseback, or you traveled by foot or by canoe. And those congregations all survive. And so you get into Henry County, and it's still 60% Lutheran. So it's contrast. Ohio District probably represents one of the most diverse areas, but it's great contrast. The tragedy, and this brings you to the contemporary scene, the tragedy of a congregation where old President Schwann was at is Zion in downtown Cleveland, the mother church. It's a tragic story. There's 30 people left. They're dying. Congregation's dying. They closed their doors 35, 40 years ago. They only wanted to serve themselves. And they wanted to stay straight and pure, but they didn't want to reach out. There's only 30 or 40 left. The two buildings are falling apart. They ask us to come in and help them. But they're more than a generation late. I feel terrible about that, because you get into Old Trinity Solard here. You get into Orlando, a wonderful downtown church. You get into Historic Trinity in Detroit. You get into First St. Paul's in Chicago. So there's a great history of those early congregations. But Cleveland's legacy, we let it slip by, and it's dying in that particular congregation, and they've never moved beyond the past, and they won't even let the present get near, and now they're in a state of panic. What I want to do as we work through this theme, I decided to do some sound bites or bullets, and I thought that was almost the easiest way to do it, short little phrases, because that's quite part of the challenge today. You're dealing with a generation of MTV people. You're dealing with a generation of people, and some of you belong to that generation, of sound bites, short attention span, the visual, and how do you communicate. But I'm going to do some of that almost as the way of communicating today. Number one, and I would say this for all district presidents, I am a pastor at heart. You can take me out of the parish as you did 3 years ago, or as our synod did, but you'll never take the parish out of me. I'm a relational person. I'm a people person. I'm a teacher, and so I travel, and I visit, and I do hands-on ministry, just as I did it in some of your rooms and apartments down there and at the meal tables. Don't ever lose that. That's what the pastoral ministry is all about. The second thing that I think of is the word pastoral formation. I'm not one of those critics who keep moaning and groaning, the seminary should have done this, why didn't the seminary do that? I think most of that's kind of silly. I really don't believe in doing that. I think why you're here is foundational and formational. When you leave, it's going to be more formational. But one of the most telling things we learned a number of years ago is that seminary instruction and ministry is pastoral formation. And pastoral formation is a whole lifetime. And if you don't walk away with anything else, understand this. that I'm still in pastoral formation. I'm still working on it, and I'm still studying it. To be a pastor is a process. To be a pastor is not an end result. To be ordained is not some kind of charm laid upon you, but it is the church's identification of your call, and you're in process and in growth the whole time. It's interesting, when in years past, our synod primarily invested in the seminary education. And that's where all the money went in. And so then when you were graduated, that was the end of it. No more investment. That model has changed in our district and many other districts. And now we make a major investment in the ongoing pastoral formation. Tomorrow I will be doing an interview. We're in the process of calling a full-time, for the district, a full-time director of ministerial health, a called pastor, whose mission and ministry is to care for the pastors and their families and the teachers in their families. It is to be proactive in helping them become healthy families, spiritual-based. It is reactive to deal with a whole host of serious problems that are just amazingly time-consuming and draining. But that's one way today we have changed. We're now investing people in the ongoing care and training. We're investing in things from Parish Leadership Institute to that so-called PALS program to a host of other ventures and a host of other ways in which we're trying to cultivate and nourish pastors. That represents a shift. You don't arrive and graduate. It's pastoral formation. It's rest of the lifetime. And secondly, understand that the church is making a sizable investment in the ongoing care and feeding of its professional workers. One of the things I like to share as you look at the world that's really unchristian and unchurched today is that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Really remember that when you leave here. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And they're looking for you to bring Jesus Christ to them, and that gospel, and that touch of the Savior, and that healing. Another way of putting it is, people won't listen to your story when you come, no matter how exciting it is. People will not listen to your story until you listen to their story and you make their story your own. Now, for some of you, John F. Kennedy, who was one of our heroes when I grew up, comes before your time. But that's okay. But what made John F. Kennedy great was when he visited behind the Berlin Wall and he struggled with a German phrase, and he looked at all of these people locked in behind the wall, and he said, "Ich bin ein Berliner." You have to make their story your story, their tears your tears, their joys your joys. And only when that takes place does ministry effectively begin to happen. I talked about that church out in Shum, a founding congregation of our synod, Zion Shum it was called, and it was a pastor Shum, it was a crossroads. And there was, the Sunday I was there, there was a Shum family reunion. And they apologized. They only had 250 people at that reunion. They have a book this thick on the family tree. I would suspect that at the seminary there has to be one, two, or three people connected to that Shum family tree. But they adopted me into that, see? And all of a sudden I became a Shum. And when that happened, then that became my story. The word today is multicultural or cross-cultural work. And we tend to identify cross-cultural with ethnic. We tend to identify cross-cultural with race. You need to identify cross-cultural with age. You need to identify cross-cultural with class and occupation. That's the biggest challenge there is. It is a cross-cultural, multicultural society. And that does not necessarily mean that those who are the youngest will look for the most novel. Some of the youngest are the most conservative. So some of the patterns that you expect aren't there. But that's where the challenge comes in preaching. It comes in worship, it comes in music, it comes in styles, it comes in a lot of other things that you do. We're talking about cross-generational work. We're talking about multi-generational work. Racism is well and alive today. When I graduated from here in 1961, I served a church on the south side of Chicago. This was this green kid, not married, coming out of the seminary. I was at 148th Street. And we received some members in our congregation who came from churches in Chicago, confirmed, dyed-in-the-wool Missouri Synod members. But they were black. They're Chicago. And they came into our congregation, and all hell broke loose. And the members would look at me and stare me in the face and say, "Why didn't you turn them away, Pastor, like Pastor so-and-so did at that church, and Pastor so-and-so did at that church, and Pastor so-and-so did? Why did you let them in? Why didn't you turn them away?" I thought eventually we became of age in racism, but it's still there. So you're going to have to struggle with that kind of diversity. You're going to have to struggle with that kind of challenge. It's well and alive. It's interesting to serve a congregation in the university scene like I did at Kent State University, which was, and again, I was in the residential part. But you become much more sensitive to gender issues. And I'm not talking about a feminist agenda. Most of that's nonsense. I'm not talking about that. But you do learn sensitivity, and you do learn not only sensitivity, but you learn to understand what's going out there. We need to struggle with those issues. If you talk about what's going on in the world today and in our congregations today, and I think every district president would tell you this, the biggest struggle still remains what I call people skills and rigidity. I do a lot of traveling because it's a large district, and so I stay at a lot of different motels. And over the time, I've ended up in staying only at one chain because they're miles ahead of all the other chains, and I get very good prices. If you know how to shop for the prices, you can beat their price. I'll get a marvelous price, and that's something operated by Marriott, whether it's a Marriott hotel, whether it's a Courtyard, whether it's a Fairfield. But when you walk in the door, and when they take care of you, they know how to take care of you. Now, you know Bill Marriott's background as a Mormon, but you have to understand, Marriott does not own any of those properties. They're just a hotel management company. They don't own any properties. But they spend a tremendous amount of energy, teaching people skills. And I can tell you what's wrong with all the other chains because I've stayed there. And you're treated as an inconvenience, or they're kind of point where stuff is, or they'll let you kind of wing it and then hope that you're grateful that you stayed there. And you walk into one of these and they know how to take care of you. Part of me says sometimes I wish in our synod we could contract out to Marriott Corporation, not just for food service in the kitchen, but contract out to them for some people skills stuff. I'm delighted as I worked here and talked with students. I think there's just a wonderful atmosphere going on here, but don't underestimate that. That's where pastors get into trouble, and that's where the challenge is. I probably have one or two within our district who just want to be contentious and argumentative and want to win. And for the two, I have 173 who want to love like Jesus Christ and be with them and move in their homes and walk and work with them. But you need to think about that style and people's skills, because the reality is that's where it gets bogged down. I want to talk about the shortage of pastors. You've read about it, and that is correct. There is now a shortage of pastors. And every district president agonizes and wrestles with it. There are long lists of calling congregations, and they're hard to fill. And then I add another disclaimer to that. If it's a shortage of pastors, it's a massive shortage of what I call qualified workers. And I want to talk about how some things have changed. Today, congregations are much more focused. You might not like that when I say that, but that's the reality. We want a pastor who's strong in outreach. We want a pastor who's strong in family ministry. We want a pastor who can develop us in worship areas. We want a pastor who can do team ministry. We're an inner city church. We want a pastor. I frankly do this now. I'm an inner city church, and they've now called, and I think this will work out. But I wrote them and said, I'm going to give you a list of one. Don't even look for eight or nine names. I'm going to give you a list of one. And I flew across the country to interview that person, and I think he'll be a good match. But that's how focused it is, and how challenging and how narrow it is. That's a massive shift where we're looking for more qualified workers. Family ministry today is still embryonic, and I know you're concentrating on that here. But let me give you a couple of examples of what I call family ministry. You get this young woman, Kathy, with her three little children, coming to church. And she kind of drags her husband, Mike, along. He works at one of the long-distance companies on the technology. And you get to know him, and he keeps coming every other week. And she keeps coming, and he keeps coming. And you know what's in their mind. There's only one thing in her mind, and she had some good Lutheran roots. And she wants to make sure that that marriage stays together and the kids don't fall off the deep end. And so when you get these young families of seekers walking in, that's your starting point, and that's what they're asking about. How in the world do we keep this home and family together? And you start working with them, and you start loving them, and you start teaching them, and you start bringing them to Jesus Christ. Family ministry, team ministry. There's a standard joke now among our district presidents when we're looking for team members. We usually send out a little memo and says, I have this church and they're looking for someone strong in youth ministry and family ministry. I received one from another district. They had two. Oh, Herb Miller over here in Southern Illinois sent us one. And I forget what his second one was. And he sends out this memo, needs some names. And the standard response from all of us is, Herb, when you find them, send me the names also. I'm looking. That's how scarce it is. I want to encourage some of you to think about team ministry. We still talk about ministry as lone rangers. I served in team ministry. It's very, very fulfilling, and we need a lot more of that. So what is happening is that the congregations in their calling, whether you agree with it or whether you disagree with it, it's kind of irrelevant. They're much more focused, and they know much more in terms of the direction they're going. We're probably working with a We don't like to use the vacancy numbers, and when you hear those, we don't like to use those. I like to use the number of calling congregations, and I think today, I don't know what that number is, someplace between 500 and 600. It will shrink after placement, and then it edges up. So you don't talk about vacancies because there's about 200 or 300 congregations out there that are vacant that are going to remain vacant. You know, they're served by a retired pastor. They're coupled with another congregation or so forth, so they're not really vacant. You talk about the calling ones. But the number keeps edging up, and the number of qualified workers to match these keeps getting more and more difficult, and it causes a great amount of soul-searching as we do this. There's a flip side to that, and I ran into this now in the last 2 years three times, and I don't know where this came from. Pastors who are, I'm going to use marketing language, pastors who now directly market themselves to a congregation. And I dealt with it, and I caught a lot of flack for it from the pastor and his family. I caught a lot of flack from it. But they'll write up this dossier, and they'll write up some of the evaluation forms. This one pastor that did it wrote up quite a, I never saw a pastor rated that high, but he wrote it up on himself, and he had it hand-delivered to this congregation. And when I wrote back and said there's a lot of things that don't match, they were very angry with me. But he was in the job of promoting and marketing himself. And I've run into that three different times. I'm not sure where that's coming from. Remember this, part of our tradition, and I really believe this, is that the office seeks the man does not seek the office. The office seeks the man does not seek the office. That's part of our tradition. And if we lose that, we're going to be in deep, deep trouble. And I think you and I need to work with that. But that's part of the scene that's going on out there today. And those are some of the struggles that we deal with. There's something related to that. I will get documents from pastors today. And there's nothing wrong at all as a pastor goes through his journey and feels that, I use this terminology, that the Spirit is nudging you to look at another direction in your ministry. And they get in touch with me, and I listen, and I try and respond, and I try and work that through. But then I look at their materials and the things they write when the congregations are that focused. I help them They have to be very honest on what they write about themselves, but I help them refocus it a little bit, because they will talk about wanting to do some graduate degrees and some esoteric topics and things like that. I will tell them that's not what the congregation is looking for. They're looking for your care for people. They're looking for your outreach. They're looking for your sensitivity. They're looking for your gospel approach. They're looking for you to be as a pastor. And so I think pastors, and I think those who are always seeking, have to ask and have to deal with those kind of questions. I really believe in the unrelenting call of God. And after 38 years, every place I've ever served is the last thing I expected to be doing. And I would try and argue with God, and I would try and challenge it. And God's call is unrelenting, and He won't stop, and He keeps plugging with you. And now I'm convinced that the authenticity of the call is in inverse proportion to that which you desired. And so if you're on some kind of track and everything's falling in place, and this is what I always wanted to be, what I always wanted to do, then I tell the pastor, you take another look at that. And I'm not sure how authentic that is. And if you're called into places and situations and arenas which are a far cry from what you thought they were, you probably have a very, very authentic call. I think some of you sitting here understand that. How in the world you ended up with the seminary, right? You've been trying to escape it since you were 21. You tried in 25, you were tugged at it, and then you went into this career. Then you tried again in 30, and you raised a family, and then all of a sudden you're here at age 37 or something like that. That, my friends, is the unrelenting call of God. You need to understand it in that context. I began at a wonderful vicarage in 1959, believe it or not, in Buffalo, New York, and the so-called bishop just became president of the Eastern District. Those were the days when they still served the congregation and you got a vicar. And so there I was, and it was a hot August 31st. I began on September 1st, so I proudly arrived on August 31st and unloaded my car and went over to his house for supper. He says, well, I tell you what, you ought to come along with me. We have a council meeting tonight. And this was old St. Paul's Church in Buffalo. And sure enough, it was a pretty stormy council meeting. And they argued about all sorts of trivial things. And, I kind of sat there exhausted. About two-thirds, and I still have the note, about two-thirds through the meeting, he slips me a little note from his memo pad. Says, don't worry, somehow God gets his job done. And that's true. Somehow God gets his job done. The other one, and this has to do with call, even now, God knows your address. God knows who you are. He knows what the needs are. He knows your address, and He will move you, and He will work with you. I look at the controversies that are going on in our church today. I look at the controversies that were going on in the late 50s and early 60s. I look at the controversies that were going on in the 70s. What do you think let's use 1960 as the year. What do you think was the big the big church controversy that got all the press in the right-wing church journals? And this was out of a little one in Iowa, because they were the ones that wrote in those days. I don't forget what it was called, but it was in Iowa. What was the controversy that the seminary was under attack for in 1958, 59? They were called Romanizing Tendencies. And the sign of Romanizing Tendencies were twofold. One was that you wanted acolytes, about as serious as you can be on this, and that you were advocating the wearing of a surplice on top of a cassock, right, Richard? Surplice on top of cassock instead of a black gown. And those were fighting words. And seminary and pastors were under attack for that. That's important when you see how the times change, which gets me to an illustration of what one of our pastors used. And when you talk about the issues, I want you to think of this in terms of a wheel. So here's a big wheel with a lot of spokes and a hub. And there's two ways we can describe the hub. We can either describe the hub as the proclamation of the gospel, Jesus Christ is our Savior. That's the hub. and everything else revolves and feeds out of it. The other way to describe it is to talk about the article of justification by grace through faith. Ultimately, that's the article by which the church rises or falls, okay? So you can use them together, you can use them interchangeably, you can use them whatever way you want. That's the hub. It's important that you remember, folks, that's what the hub is all about. That's keeping the main thing the main thing. So that the doctrine of Scripture, fellowship issues, communion issues, worship issues, and you go right on down the line, those are not the hub by which the church rises or falls. Those are kind of the spokes in this wheel. You know, they're very important, and they serve a role, but they're not the hub, and they're not the focus. I remember seeing it in writing, and I'm sure it was well-intended, and it was the controversies in the 70s, and someone was just vehemently writing that, and that's when the issue of the doctrine of Scripture was, you know, really being played out in our synod. But someone wrote very vigorously, if we lose the doctrine of Scripture, that and nothing else will cost us our identity as the church and what the church is all about. And it's the doctrine of Scripture. I said to myself, that's not Lutheran. The article by which the church rises and falls is the doctrine of justification by grace through faith. Doesn't mean those other issues aren't important, but it's important that we understand what that wheel is all about. And it's kind of fun if you've done it now for a number of decades to watch how the issues change. Okay? That gets us to the point, if we feel that we have the truth, which I really do believe, then we dare not hide it. I use the word hermetically sealed. We dare not keep it to ourselves and hermetically seal it. God has entrusted us with that law and gospel, that powerful redeeming message. In every place, in every shape, in every form, the way we can witness to it, we dare not hide it. One of the phrases that I want, if you haven't learned this, and I almost have made it a policy, it's an unwritten policy in our district, but in the Ohio district, at least in my presence, you are not allowed to talk of synod. When you say synod, you have this scowl and you say, synod says, you know, it's a synod. Or you want to get even more vigorous, you say, the synod, and you have to have that scowl. That's forbidden language. It's our synod. It's my synod. I'll talk with you about our synod anytime you want. I'll talk about my synod. But it's not synod as some kind of entity out there. And I think that's a very healthy way of thinking what our church is about. It's our synod. It's our walking together. It's my synod. It's our church. And God, in his wisdom, has put us together. And he has put us together to make this work. Preaching, homiletics, communication, attention spans, sound bites, MTV. It was fascinating to sit in classes and hear the professors talk about those kind of things and how you communicate. Whether it was a class on the confessions, how you communicate with junior high kids. That was kind of fun with Dr. Kolbe to hear him talking about teaching the catechism to junior high, and I enjoyed that. Or to be in some of the other classes in the homiletics with Professor Utek, where we're talking about how do you communicate. But I think that's the struggle. But understand it as process. Understand it as formation. And the kiss of death is say, I finally got it. I finally got it all put together, and I finally got it down. And if you ever say that, then you're dead, because it's process. You work on it, and you work on communication, and you work on sharing. I raised this statement. I think I'm going to generate some discussion with this. I raised this statement, but I will tell you it. I honestly believe in it. At the devotion last night, when we talked about pastoral ministry, and I like to think of it in terms of two dimensions. That the pastor does ministry. We're talking about preaching. We're talking about word and sacrament. But he equips people to do ministry. If you're uncomfortable with the phrase equipping to do ministry, then you can change it into discipleship, equipping people for discipleship. But it's not an either or, it's both and. It's wrong for the pastor to say, that's not my job, that's theirs. I got news for you. I have mowed lawns. I have washed dishes. One time I even played the organ at a service. You try and do that once when the organist comes down with the flu an hour before the service, and the console's in the back. I did it. I could preach, and I ran back and played a couple of hymns. They had to do the hymn before the sermon a cappella, but there were some interesting things that we could do with that. That's all part of doing ministry and administering word and sacrament. But the other part is equipping God's people. And I tell pastors that I am the sum total of all sorts of wonderful people who have cared for me, whether it was Dr. Peepcorn or Dr. Charlemagne or that lady named Phyllis that I talked about with one of the groups, a wonderful lay person. She took such good care of me that she became the interview team, and some of you sitting here were interviewed by her husband and wife, you were interviewed by her and her husband in the admissions interview. But you are this, under God's grace, in spite of you, you are the sum total of a lot of wonderful things that a lot of wonderful people did for you. There's a painting, kind of a neat painting, of a storm. You have to picture this painting with the clouds, dark clouds, lightning dashing up and down, terrible broken rocks jutted out, a wooden ship smashed against the rock, sailors floundering in the water. And then in the center of that water was a big rock, a rock of ages, jutting out of the water. And the painter put this fella with both hands around the rock, and so he was kind of saved from the storm and being dashed against the rocks. And he said, that's what it's all about. That's what the church is. And that's what mission, evangelism, outreach, and care are all about, hanging onto that rock of salvation. And then the painter said, no, that's not what it is. And so he took his brush and took a neutral color, and he painted out the bottom half. And so the dark storm clouds were still there. You just had to look at it, and you knew it was a terrible storm with lightning and wind, and the rocks were there, terrible rocks. And the ship was there, smashed against the rocks. And the sailors were floundering in the water. He put that back in. Then he even put that rock of ages back in. But this time, the sailor who was saved had only one hand around the rock instead of two. He had one hand around the rock, and the other hand was reaching in the water, reaching out to some of the other sailors. And I think that's what ministry is all about, and that's the heart and core of it. I learned it here at the feet of my teachers. In my visit these 3 days, I have gained more than I have given. And so I thank you for that privilege and opportunity. We have a few moments for questions. And if you ask questions, I'll talk about anything you want, with a caveat that the management makes no guarantees.
Thanks for your presentation and for being with us. My question is about the shortage of pastors. And I found it interesting that you mentioned how your grandfather was a staff of one, except for your mother.
Yes.
At the district office. And then you mentioned how you might be calling a new staff person to mm-hmm. your district office who yeah. is ordained.
Yeah.
And how do you, as district presidents, understanding the shortage of pastors, the need to fill calling congregations, and then on the other hand, bring new ordained men into your district office?
Probably that you want to use the very best that you have. Since I've been president for 3 years, one of our best pastors has joined the faculty here. You know, that kind of breaks my heart, but he's a good pastor, Pastor Seleska. Okay? I happen to know that others in our district are being looked at for that kind of work too, see? And my answer to that is that, you know, you need to put, it's a multiplier effect. You need to put the best in these kind of positions because the multiplication effect of people they can influence, they will multiply the gifts and goods that they have with the more people they work. Interestingly enough, one of our largest and most rapidly growing congregations is Royal Redeemer in North Royalton. That pastor is very gifted. Large, large congregation. Right now they have two pastors, and he has an uncanny ability to train lay people, for positions. And eventually then they become positions, paid positions within the congregation. And he always says that, how do you know when it's time to pay them? It's when you can't get a volunteer to do any work like that, then you have to pay somebody. And he has more half-time and quarter-time workers. But it's really multiplying ministry when we're talking about it. and how do you get the most effective use, you know? And you want to build on strength. By the way, that's the other one when we talk about team ministries, and I think that has to do with the seminary. We build on strength. You want the strongest people you can find. I want the strongest pastors. Congregations want the strongest pastors they can find. And so you're building on strength, but great question. Other comments? We have about 2 minutes or something. Yeah, Jay.
With all the challenges that you've said earlier this morning, what opportunities are there for pastors in districts for continuing education to meet those specific needs, cross-cultural, family ministry, ethnic, that sort of stuff?
Very good. There is a church planting track. There is a church planting track, and we took a vicar last year, and we're going to have a vicar from here who's on that track internally right now. So there's a church planting track. I would hope eventually we can have an urban church worker track, that you already start some of that at the seminary. But then you have to go out and you have to find. Some of that is in Lutheran circles, some of that is not in Lutheran circles. The pastor of my congregation, the congregation I now belong to, did a D-Min in Michigan. It's some Dutch seminary in Michigan. It was in communications. He's an outstanding preacher, and he's taught me a lot about communications. But he had to seek it out. You have to seek it out, and you have to seek out the very best that you can. He wanted to learn about communications. I mean, they made him work, and they made him write, and they made him start all over and everything. He's a very effective communicator and teacher. But some of those are within our circles, and some of them aren't. And you have to search, you have to ask, and you have to look. It's interesting, I did my work at LSTC in New Testament Theology. If I were to have done it again, I would have done it totally different, and I might have taken CPE and a couple of other things instead. Although it was a good coursework that I did. They're around. Some of them are offered by the district, but some are outside. We'll try and help you find some money then.
I'd like to take the first question, but end up in a slightly different place.
Sure.
You spoke about the shortage of pastors and the great number of calling congregations.
Mm-hmm.
You also spoke about team ministry.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a desire and a heart for team ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's a part of my heart that also wonders, too, about the stewardship of giving congregations a second pastor when so many will go without any pastor.
Yeah.
From a district president's perspective, could you address that thought?
What you would be dealing with in a case like this would be a congregation of 1,200 members. So that's one pastor for every 600. And some congregations are 90 or 120 members, so you can use your own math on that. Some smaller congregations really need to be coupled with other congregations and serve by one pastor and cluster these three smaller ones together, or bring a retired pastor in and have him do that. So you measure it in terms of the total number. You need to know when we do team ministries, we start with the pastor who's there and we ask for where his strengths are, what his gifts are, so that the second pastor becomes complementary to that. That's the old model was you got so big, you need another pastor, you called another one, and they duplicated all of the work. That's not really the model anymore. We look at all the needs of the congregation, you look at the gifts of the pastor, and then you take the second pastor as complementary to that. And I tell those congregations, I said, then you call from strength. You call for a very strong worker to complement. The hard part is I've got some congregations that are now entering their third year in this search. It is scarce, believe me, so I would commend you on that. I hear bells ringing and I see a clock, and so I thank you for your hospitality. God bless you all.